It's episode 2, the one on the left. We dissect the Weta effect video. Less repulsive than dissecting an actual Weta.
Visual effects, the craft of storytelling, and the people who make magic for screens both big and small. Hosted by showbiz veterans and new media entrepreneurs, Sean Apple, PJ Foley, and Ephraim Patel.
So PJ, you had some old business left over from last week. You had a tease. What was that about?
It was a cliffhanger. we were riffing about the absurdity of how movies are made or plotted or designed. It's talked a little bit about movies getting driven by ratings rather than any kind of storytelling chops or sensibilities.
Right. Specifically, we were talking about the movies that typically play on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Right, right. Like creature plus creature disaster movie. And that was reminding me of how many times I had to work on creatures. We would model them and rig them a few months ahead of actual, you know, they're probably shooting the movie, editing the movie, and we'd be working on the design of the creatures. And we get notes back basically designing that creature by committee. Had to make everyone happy. And keep in mind that the script had already usually been approved at this point. A lot of it had, or all of it had been shot. They shoot these things very quickly. Like 3 weeks is a luxury shoot for one of these. And so you end up with creatures that have capabilities that there is no footage shot to ever showcase it. Or to get a death in that way, because let's say you need to put a knife tail on an alligator. And there's never a scene where it makes sense to kill a guy with a knife tail.
So it literally is like, so the plates are pretty generic. And it's just like, just glue a monster in there and then something interesting happens.
And then we have to make sure that Sharktopus has bone knives sticking out of its gills.
That's right.
But why?
And it never made any sense.
It never came into play. There's also like a I guess it's a squid beak rather than an octopus beak on the belly of Sharktopus. And there's one shot, very distant shot, that we were managed to work it into a shot, but nothing was
on its belly.
So yeah,
what,
like,
it looks like it's dry humping someone when it's eating them.
Yeah, there's a shot where the guys fall off the edge of the boat, off the edge of the ship, and you see Sharktopus come up like halfway, kind of jaw style, but then it bites the guy's head with its belly button and throws the head away.
That can happen.
So what's
that
the idea? Happen. Basically, there are producers in the food chain who are just like, oh, well, you know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see him have three arms.
Yeah, and it shoots fire, and they can fly.
I want to be that guy, because I'm just going to make shit up. Okay, here's what it needs. And then just go into like, and eat six ankles.
That would be an amazing career to have. I kind of want to see just like some like fly on the wall video of that guy's day.
Right.
Like he walks in, you know, he said, no, it needs to have tentacles to shoot fire.
And they get pissed when it's like, how many times? I said six. You only have five in there. Like, really? We're going to argue over that.
Right.
That's going to make the difference in this movie.
I would argue that those people probably forget as soon as they walk out of the room what they said, because it doesn't actually impact anything down
it doesn't,
the line.
Except for their ego.
Right.
And they remember if you didn't do what you told them to do.
Right.
Or they told you them to do.
But it never works the other way around. Keep that in mind.
Right.
Never.
That's why it's better to be that guy. I wanted to bring up something kind of riffing on that real quick. I've only worked on a couple of these, a couple. And then all the way back.
Probably more than you remember.
Well, and then they
do kind of run into each other.
I've had therapy since then. So, but the one that was the strangest was the heebie-jeebie that actually Ephraim created. So I don't, was that your thing, or was that noted, or what?
The heebie-jeebie, I came into it in sort of mid-design. Sketches had already been done, but no one was building it. And as it was explained to me, there had been a mining accident. There were all these Chinese, I think, miners back in like 30, 40 years ago that had been trapped in a mine collapse, and they were mining for gold. And the heebie-jeebie was the present-day monster version of these. Basically, three or four or five Chinese minor corpses were fused together into some malevolent creature with this huge sort of maw, this huge like hole in that, it for, a, that was for the part, a stomach.
That was the part I didn't get. Like, I got all the, it's kind of a fused together thing. That part I got, I didn't get the whole stomach thing.
Well, like, well, at first when I saw the sketches, it, you know, the ribs, all the different rib cages that were mushed together around the side, it looked like teeth. So I'm like, okay, this is like a maw where it will eat people.
Right.
That might be gnarly.
But could you, you could see through, could you see it through?
You no,
could,
no,
you
could, no.
You couldn't see their head.
No,
back
it wasn't like
it.
A donut. You could right. see into, so okay. it was like a big stomach. So I'm like, okay. But then once it was, after it was built, I heard that, oh no, it's actually, what we're going to see in there, instead of all of its innards inside the mouth, it's going to be smoke. Right. Some sort of weird mm-hmm. smoke, because what it does instead of eating people with this big maw is it makes some sort of mist that makes them scared, because that's cinematic.
And
so the fear is to be scared. The fear is not death. The fear is to be scared.
Yeah, so it's just some mist, and then people are like, I don't know why I'm so scared. And this thing was, you know, it had one leg that was like two legs fused together, and another right. Another leg like that was a torso.
25 minutes to go 3 feet.
And it could not. It was mechanically completely unsound. It could. It was hobbling around. It looked ridiculous, and it had no part of it was actually lethal.
You could actually go up to it and push it over.
You could. You could. And here was the other thing that it did. Like, some producer was like, it should eat gold.
Yeah.
Well, it should.
Because that makes so much sense. That
right.
It hungers for gold.
It's an allegory, man. It's like eating gold is like, it's a greedy monster, man.
Because, yeah, except that it's, yeah, it's like the lesson, if there was one, should have been that, like, no, don't be so greedy about gold that allow people to die.
These are the guys who died.
And get scared really bad.
Died because of the greed and because of the search for gold. And right. so they're going to come back as a monster that searches for gold and right. eats it. Because
it's a hard lesson to learn. It's a hard lesson to learn.
Sometimes lessons don't make sense.
It eats it, and not to take it away from them, but to puke it back on them.
Right, right. right.
So it's kind of like fly. Gold. It's like a fly kind of thing.
Sometimes truth sounds a lot like a lie.
That's right, because I got nothing.
So the heebie-jeebie, yeah, but that was, you know, one of those monsters by committee.
At least in that case, the smoke was written into the script, and they did shots where people were getting scared,
shouldn't have.
But here's they really shouldn't have. But that's sort of like the opposite of nature. Like a Venus flytrap makes a smell that attracts flies and it captures them. If you were getting scared by something, you'd probably go the other way.
You'd probably run. Right. Yeah. But right. even if you didn't run, even if you were frozen to the spot, the heebie-jeebie could come right up to you and it had no agency to hurt you.
Right. It was like, I'm going to be here.
I'm going to take your gold and eat it.
You know, the thing that I did that made no sense from a technical standpoint is it's got a smoke stomach. So comping that in made no sense. It's right. like, so when it moves, the smoke, no, it just stays.
Oh,
it
yeah.
just kind of stays there. It's a local, it's like a relative thing. Yeah. You know?
We couldn't emit custom particles per scene.
Come on, man. There's no budget for that. We had tons of time.
But that's one of my pet peeves in visual effects in movies. And I think I've mentioned this to you guys before. When it seems like a director or a writer has no idea for something.
So you get all the ideas.
It's a particle effect. Almost right. always, it's a particle effect.
Ephraim's tombstone will say, no particles.
Died something. Watching some goddamn particle effect.
Because you didn't have an idea, you did some particle
the
shit.
The first shot of a movie, you're sitting down, there's the opening, you know, the credits, and then it's, I'm watching a particle effect. It's just particles swirling around. It's pretty, and it's a lot of math. But it's clearly no one's got an idea here.
The idea was particles.
Yeah.
It's the magic dust from the dust realm that comes through the portal of evil, and the evil is a swirling smoke.
You know the first time where I saw that, where I thought that, but it was a sound cue too that made it work, that was really cool, was the night, was it Nightcrawler? What's the character that
In X-Men.
X-Men. You know how it popped on, it popped off? Use. Yeah, and I was like, oh, that feels purposeful. It was about the snap and the sound cue too. Right. I was like, oh, that's a different way of doing that.
I don't want to suggest that I think particle effects are bad.
But
I mean,
they are.
they're very difficult, and the people who do them deserve a lot of respect.
No, they don't. It's a button.
No.
Yeah, right.
Water, smoke.
So easy to change too.
All that stuff is very difficult, and when it's done well, it's brilliant. And when it supports the story in a way that makes some kind of sense, it's wonderful. But when it's a crutch, it's miserable.
But that, and that's really, that boils down to a lot of CG. Is like it's because we can, as opposed to should you?
Right.
Did that make sense in this case? Does that help push the story along?
Lost smoke monster was a smoke monster, so it probably did, you know, it deserved to be particles.
Right. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean one of the cases that always comes to mind, and it's a little old, but The Fifth Element, which I'm one of the few who wasn't crazy about that movie.
I'm mixed about it.
Yeah.
It took him like 27, he's like, I drew that character when I was 5.
It just felt like, you know, it was one of those kitchen sink movies where there was no idea too silly, no design too wacky, no Chris Tucker scene that shouldn't be cut.
All of them.
Anyway, the big evil. It's like, we gotta do the big evil is coming. What? Show us the big evil. And it cuts to the big evil in space, and it's just a cloud of particles.
So back to the part. You know, here's the thing. This, and I think this is just my personal taste, but I don't like my badass sci-fi and cute mashed up. Mm. I don't like cute stuff. You know what I mean? Like, because it pulls me out of it. It's like, it's not that badass. You know, it's like Han Solo and Ewoks. It's like, I'm not feeling that. I mean, that's cool. I get it. Teddy bears and, yeah.
Yeah. So this is sort of a segue, but I'd like to bring up a little bit of old business from last podcast. You guys brought up the Weta effect video.
Yes.
YouTube video that's been making the rounds. On the social medias called the Weta effect.
Do you know what? I'm sorry. Should we describe Weta? Are there people that don't know what Weta is?
Weta is a visual effects company in Wellington, New Zealand. It was started by Peter Jackson and Richard Taylor, and they're responsible for some of the most impressive work that's been out there in the last 15 years. They're responsible for all the Lord of the Rings movies. They're also responsible for some films that didn't work as well, like King Kong and The Lovely Bones and some other things. But they do, by and large, really, really impressive work. And they've arguably sort of moved the quality of visual effects forward, especially in the realm of CGI characters.
Right.
They're the ones who first brought us Gollum, which is one of the first CGI characters that had to really perform for a lot of screen time in these movies.
Right.
And that was a revelation, and it worked. It wasn't perfect, but it really worked.
And might be the first... Is that sort of the first movie star that's come from that?
I think
Andy Serkis?
I don't know if
he's a bona fide movie star, but he's a known guy now. You know?
Yeah, and he's gone on to not only do live action... He was in the last Avengers movie.
Right.
But he's also playing a lot of CGI characters like Caesar in the Planet of the Apes films.
Right.
Among others. So that's Weta. They also were responsible for doing the work in James Cameron's Avatar, which, say what you will about it, the visual effects were amazing. Because one of the more challenging things to do, the most challenging thing to pull off in visual effects are characters and creatures. And then within that, the most challenging things to pull off are characters and creatures that look and behave as closely to human beings. The closer you get to human beings, the closer you get to what's called
the uncanny valley.
The uncanny valley, which is basically, we know how humans move, we know how they look, we look at them every day, obviously, and so we are very quick to pick up on any little thing that does not seem real, and it will pull us out. Now, if it's someone who is a human that is sort of like a cartoon version of a human, like let's say in Despicable Me or The Incredibles, these are basically...
Like Pixar.
Yeah, Pixar. They're caricatures. Yeah. They're cartoon characters. We don't expect them to look like physically accurate human beings. So there's a lot of creative license, and we suspend our disbelief for those films. But as soon as you start trying to make something that looks like it should be in the real world, then it becomes more challenging. And the characters in Avatar, they behave very close to human beings, even though they were blue and cat-like. The work there was amazingly impressive. So that's Weta Digital. So this YouTube video basically seems to be taking the position that movies have gotten worse, And there's a reason why. In fact, his opening line, have you ever watched newer movies and felt like something's missing?
No.
I mean...
I'm fulfilled. I think every movie I see...
Yeah. Like the magic is gone? Well... Okay, so that's the opening question. That's a setup. Have you ever watched newer movies and felt like something's missing, like the magic is gone? And then he goes on to say, well, nostalgia is a real thing. But what if I told you that it's not the only thing going on? That there is, in fact, a change in modern movies that's actually making them get worse.
Okay, so you don't buy that premise.
I mean, just the writing... I don't buy. I mean,
oh, well, are we grading him on his writing, or are we going to grade him on his...
Yeah, you know.
Well, here's the thing. Well, go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like he's already contradicting himself, knowing what's coming.
But see, to defend this guy, at least I'm going to defend the writing here real quick.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched newer movies and felt like something's missing? Okay, well, maybe you did, maybe you don't. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But like the magic is gone. Well, that's his opinion. Well, nostalgia is a real thing. And I think by that he means, like, it's easy to, like, reminisce about movies that you saw when you were younger. And like, we talk about this. And when you go back and watch them, they don't hold up.
Yeah, but, okay.
So, like, nostalgia because it's part of your history, not because it was a good movie.
He's saying nostalgia is a real thing.
Right.
But what if I told you it's not the only thing going on? He's already made a leap. He hasn't established nostalgia as part of this argument at all.
Other than the fact of, like, are you remembering it better than it actually was? I think that's what he's saying.
Yeah, but he's taking these leaps. He's like assuming, I assume that in your mind, the argument is nostalgia. And yes, nostalgia is a real thing.
Right.
Like, he's making these wild...
He's countering what he thinks your... But wait. He's countering that before you have a chance.
He's assuming your answer.
Right.
Which is, by the way, yes, I've noticed that movies are getting worse. And yes, I noticed that the magic is gone. And by the way, I'm attributing it to nostalgia, that I think older movies are better than newer movies.
Oh, I think he's saying with... dissect this first paragraph. I think he's saying, like... I think he's thrown a bone to, like... Maybe they weren't as good as we thought they were. Nostalgia is a real thing.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, just from a writing standpoint, if you're going to make an argument, you need to lay out the
what
pieces
nostalgia is
before, like, you start playing with them.
You need to tell us what nostalgia means to you before for us to not,
and how it connects to the argument
at large. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So, straw man. Well, nostalgia is a real thing, but what if I told you it's not the only thing going on? As if we're all going to gasp and say it's not the only thing going on. Tell me more.
They're more expensive.
Yeah. Well, they are. Then he goes on to say that there is, in fact, a change in modern movies that's actually making them get worse.
Okay.
You see, computer graphics used to be limited to the surface aspects of a single thing in a scene, which there's so many things wrong with that statement.
Wait, I don't know where to begin.
You see, computer graphics used to be limited to the surface aspects of a single thing in a scene.
What does that mean?
Well... When you shoot with a real camera in the real world and you're shooting actors and sets, you're limited to the surface aspects of a thing.
Oh, okay, all right, got it.
So he's saying that computer graphics used to also be limited to the surface aspects of a thing, which...
No.
I don't...
You always had to shade. You always had to do something.
Yeah, I mean, spaceships in space from the beginning of CG graphics right there blows that away.
The surface aspects of a thing versus what? The interior inner life of a thing? The metaphysical aspects of a thing? What are you talking about?
I want to know what that tree's motivation is.
Yeah. I mean, it is a weird way to say you can add a monster to a scene.
Okay.
Right.
But he's also making the argument that you could only... That the computing power was limited to adding a single monster to a scene.
Or maybe the other part of that is that yes to the computing power, but then also to the you weren't generating that tree. That tree was a photographic element, so it looked like exactly what it looked like. It was what it was. There's no shader. You can't tweak it. You can't change the lighting.
Right. Which, by the way, those things happen in movies today. People shoot plates and put CGI things into the plate and integrate them with real things. It happens all the time.
Yep.
It does. But he's making the argument that movies have changed.
Okay.
In this way. You see, computer graphics used to be limited to the surface aspect of a single thing in a scene, which had to be integrated with normal shots, sometimes awkwardly. And while he's saying this, he's showing clips from Terminator 2.
Okay.
The Metal Man.
Right.
The Abyss.
Okay.
With the water tentacle.
Right.
And I will say that these were back in the day when James Cameron was pushing the limits of what computer graphics
started Digital Domain to do some of this stuff.
And he was sort of highlighting a single thing in a scene, like the water tentacle. And its surface aspects to help support the story. Now, it wasn't that the computing power was limited to a single thing in a scene. It's just that that's what they were tackling, and that's what the money and the budget
and
was just, okay with.
And the ability.
They could have made two water tentacles. They could have made a water tentacle and replaced half the room. They could have. It wouldn't have looked as good as it does today.
Well, not only that, I mean, could they have? I mean, that's a lot of computing power back then.
But you and I both know that those things aren't all rendered at the same time. You render separate elements and then you composite them later.
Right, but...
Okay. Terminator 2 did a lot of scene reconstruction. There's a lot of things that were redone that would just... I mean, today, I wouldn't say trivial, but more commonplace.
Right. Okay.
So the idea that the computer, that there was some bottleneck where they could only do one thing is kind of not correct, but we saw a lot of obvious examples of a single thing, like the single water tentacle, single metal man.
But there, I mean, the computing power was exponentially less. That's a thing. I think I made that up. But like,
well, then today,
like it might have taken 30 years to render two tentacles. This is what I'm saying.
Well,
hypothetically,
right. But it wouldn't have. But let's say hypothetically,
15 years.
Okay.
That was a hard limitation, though.
If Cameron needed two tentacles, he would have done it. But he didn't need two tentacles.
Let's ask him.
James Cameron,
call us.
Part of that is knowing the limitations of the technology and writing for what he thought he could achieve. So that was definitely part of it. But then he goes on to say, but we gained the ability to do more textures and details, and around 2004...
I don't know that date, but
2004,
whatever.
Software passed the point where it could integrate individual CGI objects with fully rendered computer-generated backgrounds.
That's such an arbitrary date.
Making everything fit smoothly. Now, he's basically saying that around 2004, we were now able to not only create a single CGI thing, but we could put it in a CGI environment.
Well, that's when the plug-in was introduced. Do you remember that?
Yeah, exactly. which he's completely forgetting the Lord of the Rings films, which were 2001, 2002, and 2003.
Right.
Which not only had CGI characters aplenty,
right,
and all kinds of CG environments. I mean, Return of the King was half of that movie was CG armies, CG creatures, and fully CG battlefields.
Was that the first time we saw lots of Massive, right?
Although I think Massive started with the earlier films. Didn't we see, like, in the opening battle in the first Lord of the Rings, where they're talking about where they first battled at Mount Doom with all the orcs? That was the first Massive.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so we're seeing that stuff through all these films. So 2001, we're seeing this stuff. And by the way, all three films nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and won in all three categories for the third movie. So the argument that CGI was making the movies worse, don't buy it.
Well... Worse, but then also Academy Award. Those could be mutually exclusive.
Well, it's true. But you know, here's another thing that another thing that bothers me about this argument is that he keeps throwing around the word movies, and we all use the word movies, but the word movie gets it gets divorced from the idea of story, and ultimately movies are stories, right?
Do you think so? I don't think. When I think of a movie, I think of a story.
You do, because you're very story-oriented. But I think the average person, when they talk about a movie, they're not thinking, I want to go see a good story. They're thinking, I want to go be entertained for 2 hours, switch my brain off, and have an escape from my normal life.
That's fine, but to hold somebody's attention for 2 hours, something's got to be going on.
Well, you know that, and I know that. Right. But I'm making a sweeping generalization about audiences.
Let's do it. Audiences are
no, but I think that the business of storytelling is it's a challenging one for most people to wrap their heads around. When you walk out of a film, to really understand why something worked or why it didn't is challenging.
It is, because you can, I mean, an audience can feel it. They can feel like, I was bored during the second act. They don't even know what the second act
exactly
is. But like, I was bored in that middle part, and then that other part I wasn't crazy about. But then that other part was awesome, but I wish they would have done more of that other part.
But I think most people are going to, they're going to talk about the things that they saw. They're going to talk about the visual things that, like, this actor bored me, or I didn't like, I thought the CGI was fake, or it was boring, or whatever.
Right.
They're not going to even...
It's going to be an impulse, or like a visceral response.
Yeah, tangible things that they're gonna grab. Right. You know, it's the sort of the intangible stuff is what stories, are really about.
Right.
And And I just want to jump forward in this Weta video. While he was talking, there were visual stuff happening all the time in the video, and one of the things that came up was just some text that said, "The fundamental purpose of storytelling, to provide feelings we enjoy, but don't get enough of in everyday life."
That's the purpose of storytelling?
You got me. That's what this guy says, is to provide feelings we enjoy. Like,
to
you
provide
know,
feelings we enjoy.
Like eating a cookie or having sex.
Sure. Delicious.
But sure. Don't get enough of in everyday life.
So we don't need stories. We could just have cookie sex all the time.
Cookie sex? Yeah.
I think that's the name.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't get enough of serial killer mystery murders in my life.
Yeah, so, because you enjoy watching someone get right. disemboweled.
Yeah, I like that kind of thing, and that's why I go to stories, so I get more.
Okay, so this guy's making an argument, but so... And that's fine. That's his prerogative, but the premise is like assumed. The premise is constantly assumed. Well, it's like, well, I think we both agree that you know.
You want to talk about the premise being assumed? Listen to this. He's okay. Hold on 1 second. He says.
By the way, we should mention that Ephraim has actually annotated this. This is the most awesome.
I couldn't pull out specific things. So he makes this whole premise. You know. Saying, the initial thrust of special effects was to use the computing power to remove the jarring contrast between the CGI and the live-action shot to make it more believable.
No.
But they ended up using that power over everything to flex their muscles and make everything in the scene look as glossy and polished as possible. And the result is now these fully CGI scenes become more and more beautiful and more impressive and more phony.
So here's my question. Who's they?
Well...
I guess we're part of the they.
Still, yeah. Jim Cameron.
Right.
And then he says, "Let me show you." And he shows two Hulks.
Okay.
Okay. We got the 2003 Hulk film on the left and the 2008 film on the right, before and after this happened.
By the way, real quick, we should also, I mean, we didn't bring this up last time. They're significantly different in their design, too. Yep. So it's like, the argument's flawed because they're two entirely different designs. So
different designs, right. Different stories, different right. storytellers. Right. I mean, there's so many things.
Right.
But we're just going to look at the tangible details. So he says, here are the two films before and after this happened.
this catastrophe
and
of CGI.
Presumably he means that 2004 switch that we passed where CGI objects could be rendered in fully CGI backgrounds. So he says, look at these two. Which one do you prefer?
I like the one on the right.
No. He says, which one do you prefer? And he says, well, for those of us who notice this, it's actually the left.
Oh, I love how, like, for people who are not assholes, I think we all agree it's the one on the left, that we all prefer, correct?
Which one do you prefer? Wrong. It's the other one. I mean, it's hilarious.
I'm just going to do that from now on. What's your favorite? No, that's not your favorite. No. I'm sorry. You're mistaken.
Funny thing is, you're wrong. For those of us who know about you, really? You're wrong. I guess what I'm saying, if you're going to get into this person's argument, you have to accept this kind of logic.
Or non-logic. Right.
And, we can have a very substantive conversation about the relative merits of computer-generated effects and how they've changed over the years and how they work to support or not support different stories. But this argument that movies have gotten worse because CGI has gotten better or whatever this argument is...
Okay, let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Okay, please do.
All right, so...
Because I love that.
So, all right. Let me tell you what you're thinking. The thing that I think... I don't know if this supports his argument or not, but I think this is in the air. And by in the air, it's my face saying it right now. That's what I mean.
Do it.
Some say... That's my favorite bullshit argument. Some say... You mean you... The one thing that I can say that I feel like sometimes in lieu of a quality story or a good script, the feeling is we already set a holiday deadline and we gotta go.
Yeah, but that's...
And so, but let me finish.
Right,
let me finish.
No.
And so instead of solving... instead of solving the story problems... They're just going to wallpaper over it with CG. And right. that is the argument that I do support. Because I see it. I'm like, if they had spent another month on the story, this thing could have killed.
But that's a different argument. And like I said, we can have that discussion.
Okay.
And I'm totally for that.
We can have it. But we're not.
In another episode.
Because there are tentpole movies that get greenlit before they're written.
Exactly.
Well, because studios know, like, well, and, this concept has enough room for spectacle, and we've got the money.
And not only that, the molds are made at Mattel. They're cranking out toys. Oh, they got, yeah. I mean, there's a whole machine behind that thing.
Right, and it's got a firm release date.
That's right.
And so why would they jeopardize all of that revenue to put the script through another 6 months to a year of work to try to make it better?
I feel like that... You know, so what every studio wants right now is a big IP, you know,
intellectual property.
And that an intellectual property, if you don't know, Marvel is an intellectual property. It's something you can, it's the meal that keeps on feeding. Probably the ultimate one is Star Wars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you guys think that's probably one of the ultimate IPs? Although Marvel's giving them a real run for their money because it's a much wider world. But I feel like that. I totally lost my point.
No, it was good.
Tell me what my point was.
I think for those of us in the know, your point was the
for
one on the
who
right.
Know you,
well,
who know?
Yeah.
Okay. So Weta guy. My feeling is this is.
Are you? You're addressing him directly.
This is
dear.
This,
well,
is,
this
is the same. The same thing that goes over and over with every evolution of media, and it comes from the point where. When photography was invented, was that art?
Right. Well,
when you could paint a picture on a computer, was that art? You know, right. You did it on a computer. That's different than painting it. That's different than taking a picture of it. And everyone has to get over these hurdles for some reason every time something new is introduced. And this is just getting in late on the argument and saying that the more CG gets advanced, the more capabilities it has, the more it's ruining the art. And there's... Definitely, it's like every other thing. It's like photography. It's like digital anything. It's a tool that can be used well. It can be used poorly. Right. And it can detract. It can probably make a movie worse as a movie. It's not going to fix a story unless the story is highly CG based and needs to be used that way.
The silent film era, when they introduced sound,
right.
That was a big deal because that was a whole new dimension to the storytelling experience, and people felt that it ruined movies.
Right.
Absolutely ruined it. And for a while, it did.
Right.
They got worse because before sound, you had to tell a very tight story visually, and you didn't have room to just jibber jabber and give a lot of exposition or a lot of nonsense. And after that, after sound was introduced, people talked endlessly and the stories dragged and people, you know, were upset.
And you know, it's interesting too. That's a really great demarcation or markation point. I don't know how you describe that because, you know, cinema in its original form was purely visual spectacle. So it was relying on the beauty of the visual, a physical gag, you know, an impressionistic view of what emotion looks like, you know, not a, I mean, you couldn't do subtle now. You couldn't do the method acting and would not read back then.
Right.
And I think that the interesting thing is that that is specific. That's very specifically one thing. But so when you added a microphone to the thing, you know, people talking into plants because the microphone sucked and stuff, so it had to be super local. You're really filming a play at that point.
Mm.
You know, and so that lost some of the spectacle a little bit of what film is, you know, or what film is really good at doing, which is the visual presentation of something, you know.
But it sounds like when you're talking about, you know, it being such a visual medium and a spectacle, it sounds like you're sort of pro visual effects and set pieces that are just a bunch of visual nonsense.
I like crap.
No, you don't. What you like.
Let me tell you what you like. Do you know what I'm saying though?
Have we reached the point of peak?
Oh. You were saying?
Go ahead. Sorry.
technical difficulties there. Have we reached the point of peak CG crap fest? And in a way, you would actually have to do some kind of subjective survey of movies that have come out in the last five or since 2004.
Right. And well, that was the big, I mean. Yeah,
that was when the turning point was.
That's right.
Have we reached a point where it's just all the peak nonsense is over and now that even on a big Marvel film, are they just using CG the way it needs to be used? But
CG doesn't make crappy movies.
Exactly.
You don't make crappy movies. Yeah, CG allows people to make crappy movies and still make money.
And do a lot of shortcuts they wouldn't probably do or couldn't do. Like a good example of that would be, I mean, the one that's almost overused now is the Jaws example. You know, like Jaws, the shark didn't work half the time, so they had to shoot around it. And in there, you find ways to indicate drama without actually showing a shark. And well, I think one of the issues now with CG is you see everything, and so there's no idea this art. Artsy, I'm going to be artsy fartsy real quick. The concept of negative space is kind of gone by the wayside with a CG movie. It's like we have to see everything.
Well, and I think what Spielberg had by accident with Jaws was a creative limitation he wasn't planning on.
That's exactly
which
right.
Which is, okay, you thought you could show the shark 20% of the time. Now you can't. Now you can maybe get like 3 or 4 half decent shots, and you have to figure out how to create suspense and fear without it.
That's right.
And so that made him really think creatively about how to do that, how to use all the cinematic tools to create the sense of a shark without seeing it.
And I think that is a useful exercise in storytelling, because the thing does not make the thing more real a lot of times. Mm. Sometimes what's going on, like here's a classic example of, like, you know, when you're watching a conversation between two people, sometimes the reactive person is the more interesting thing. We can hear the audio from the person saying the piece of dialogue, but what impact is that having? Mm. You know, and that's why, and you know, who the master of the cutaway is Spielberg, because he would, I mean, the crane shot, you know, the da 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 da, you know, the Jurassic Park where he pulls up the awe shot, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Because as cool as it is to see the dinosaurs, seeing people react to the dinosaurs is an equal part of that equation, because we don't identify with dinosaurs. We identify with people looking at dinosaurs. And so we need a proxy in the movie that is us on some level. You know what I mean? Right. And I think that idea is forgotten a little bit. And I think one of the things, and I really like the Avenger movies. I think they're good. But I don't know which one I am. Which one of these superheroes
right.
am I?
There's not really an everyman in this.
There's not.
The Thor movies do.
That's right. Well, because Natalie Portman did. Right. Yeah.
Well, even if a character isn't an everyman, if there's something that I can empathize with.
Right, a sense of humor or a flaw or something like that. Right. One of the great running gags that it's been in both the Avengers movies is who can lift Thor's hammer.
Right.
That's been kind of fun. That's been, because you can see Thor's, like, please God, don't lift the hammer, please. You know, which is fun, which I mean, is a really, that's a flaw.
It humanizes
them a bit.
It's
absolutely right.
Yeah. I think in Avengers 2, we're supposed to be Hawkeye. I believe.
I think you're right.
But even still, he's an Avenger.
I just read a thing, maybe you guys read this too, where that whole excursion, spoiler alert if you haven't seen the movie, Age of Ultron movie, that whole aside where they go to his house, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Like that, apparently there are two versions of that. There was a studio version and the Joss version, or some melding.
The studio wanted to cut it, is what I read. They held it over Joss's head because he wanted to have the cabin, and they're like, well, then you've got to do Thor going to... Oh,
this is the creative
taking
trail.
A bath. Yeah, Thor, you got to do Thor's bath, his vision quest.
By the way, that'll be the third movie, Thor's bath. Avengers, Thor's bath. That was the trade-off?
I do not want to take a bath.
Hot tub Thor machine.
Right. Oh... Yeah, that's what I read, that it was a sort of a fight.
It's interesting because, you know, if drama, I'm going to make an assumption here. I'm going to be like the waiter guy. If drama is really only, the only way drama can ever happen is through contrast. Because if, you know, if a note's at 11 the entire time, it has no effect. It's just loud. But if there's something quiet before that or quiet after that, now you have drama. Now you have conflict. I think the thing that Joss understands is that slowing down the story doesn't mean boring the story. Mm. It means giving us a space so when we come back and hit him over the head, it feels like it. Because something that's on, that's the thing that I don't think, I'm gonna burn a bridge right now.
Yeah, whoa. Do it.
Michael Bay does not do, and it drives me insane.
I was gonna mention him.
It's on 11 the entire time. And the thing is that
people like 11. People like it 11. More cowbell. Yeah, they just want it all the time.
But here's the thing is, like, I like 11 too, but I like 2 or 1 or 4 before that, because then 11 is a 30.
Yeah, but that was the boring part. When they were at 2, that was I was kind of bored. That.
Were you really?
Well, yeah. When it's 11 all the time, I get bored. I mean, I can't believe there's these super dramatic buildings collapsing, robots flying through them, explosions everywhere.
You want a nice story about two people?
And I close my eyes. I'm just like, there's no stakes. There's no nothing.
And I think that's There's no stakes.
And, well, I was wondering if either of you, I haven't, but if you've seen the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like, has he toned down? Is he focusing?
Here's the thing is that I think, and obviously I don't know Michael Bay, but I think those things make so much money that people are like, just do whatever you're doing.
Is that the peak CG barf fest, though? Is that like those movies? Are we done with those, or are they always going to be around?
I think it's in a way.
I know
it's
they sell international huge numbers.
They do, and they also don't rely on translation and humor. I mean, the humor is so broad. You know, it is. It's almost like a fix. It's like a junkie fix. It's like it's an adrenaline fix. You know, it's a movie theater adrenaline fix. Like, you know, after a while, that's my impression of adrenaline fix.
Yeah,
like
that's good. That was good. Yeah. I like that.
Most theaters I go to have that guy.
You know, the Weta video at the end sort of signed off like it was a call to action. Eventually, he said, but balancing the mundane with the fantastic accurately, because we all know what orcs look like in real life.
Well, not only that, I mean, and you got the memo of what accurate is, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's just really, it's simple.
It's total. I mean, don't know how it's people 3 pages long.
You know, what accurate is. So balancing the mundane with the fantastic accurately within a fully computer-generated shot will eventually get figured out. And
who's the guy to figure that out?
It'll get figured out because it's not yet.
Right, right.
It'll get figured out and imitated enough to spread.
Like a disease?
I don't know what any of this means. But then he says, but in the meantime, share this video so we can speed up the process. Thanks. So he really wants this to be a call to action that Hollywood will get the message their CGI more accurately.
I don't want to piss you off, but I actually did do the call to action. I contacted all the major studios.
You did.
And I said, could you please make your movies more accurate?
I think things are going to get better.
I hope so. We can only hope so.
Yeah.
If everybody got together and called the studios and said, please make Transformers more accurate.
I think what's actually happening, though, is that the studios are getting the message loud and clear that as long as they throw enough CGI spectacle at the screen, it doesn't matter how bad the story is. Not to say that there isn't some great storytelling happening in tentpole movies today. There are. But there's also some really, really, really bad storytelling.
So that's the argument. The argument is not, like, I think the argument is, it's the wallpaper argument. It's just we don't care. Just paper over. Just wall to wall.
People are voting with their dollars. That's right. What's happening.
That's right. And it's also, like somebody said earlier, it's the international dollar now, too. I mean, the whole idea, this has been gone for a while, but, like, you'd have the U.S. release, and then you'd have, like, you'd have a staggered international release. Movies are shown internationally first, and then they make their way to the United States. It's like it's almost backwards now. And I think that is a reality of, you know, you need, first of all, you're fighting piracy. And then the other part of that, too, the second part of that is there's so much content, so much competition for eyeballs now. Mm-hmm. And the third part of that, too, is that these big movies make sense where there is a language barrier. So you just throw CG at it. I mean, those are the things that are just going
to
clean house.
Well, it didn't used to be that way. For Hollywood, it used to be like in the 1980s, the 1990s, that the major box office returns were domestic. So
that's right.
You had to appeal to domestic audiences. So you could get away with things that were a little bit more nuanced and culturally based. Like, let's say a baseball movie would have been a big deal in the 80s. But now they will hardly, the conventional wisdom is do not do sports movies because they they don't play overseas.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's why we haven't seen one in a while, huh? We haven't seen a Rudy or
every
a
now and again
movie.
We get one. But also now because the financial model has flipped, now instead of making these smaller movies, Hollywood is making only tentpole movies,
right.
These enormously expensive, laughably expensive movies. That most of their revenue comes from overseas now. It's the domestic is like a bonus. So it all has to translate.
And you know what's interesting is it's almost, I wonder if that is a response to, or if it's just sort of an organic thing that happened with TV is so owning storytelling right now. you know, in such a fantastic way that I wonder if studios are like, we can't compete with a 20-hour
thing,
you know, like, so we gotta spectacle the shit out of people.
Make something, you know, that you need to go to a theater to experience, right, like the, you know, laser IMAX.
Right.
I saw Mad Max there. It was amazing. And, you know, that I would pay again for that.
But do you need to see, you don't need to see, I won't pick on any movie, but like a quiet drama. Remains of the Day in laser IMAX, no, you know, in 3D. No. It would be nice to get that stoicism
but they're
in
not,
3D.
They're not making those movies. If they get made, they're little independents.
But, well, that's, I guess that's true. And then, or it's a cable, like if you look at Downton Abbey, it's kind of that whole vibe. But like, but those things have shifted gears from feature films to long form, multiple episode. That whole format seems to have shifted.
I think those things were happening in parallel, but the, excuse me, Hollywood's move towards the tent poles and the stuff that plays well overseas, I think that was probably driven more by globalization.
Piracy.
Right. So you've got more money being spent on fewer movies, and you've got a lot of industry professionals who are now not getting the work that they were, and they start migrating to TV.
That's right.
And then the TV, you know, all the stuff on TV starts to get much, much better, and then that makes Hollywood nervous because now there's the playing field is...
And the other part of that, too, is that you have cable that could now do adult stories with adult language and sex and the whole nine, whereas broadcast television was always limited, that you could only do a certain more narrow view of what a crime drama was. And then you had Sopranos. Really, I think Sopranos was the game changer in terms of long form, balls to the wall, go for it.
Right.
You know, and then I think that blew up so big that I think people were like, it's kind of hard to go back.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like we have so much freedom. The storytellers have so much freedom on cable television. They're like, you know, although I've heard compelling arguments where people have talked about the opposite is true, because this is sort of the comedian thing where like saying fuck is easy, saying not fuck is hard, you know, getting the point across the fuck without saying it, you know. And so I think their argument for broadcast television is make Sopranos for broadcast television. You gotta be just that much more.
Creative limitation.
It is a creative limit. That's absolutely right. Yep.
So, in summary,
PJ's our clock watcher.
I'm clock watching. In summary, I like the Weta effect video because in his opening montage, he uses a shot from Anaconda 3.
Which you're very welcome.
You're very welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, PJ brought you
Anaconda. And that snake was another, not only by committee, but by a committee ahead. No prior exposure to, and then they made it, and then they only did a few of the shots, so we had to continue the movie using that particular model.
Somewhat awkwardly, he said the computer could only handle the surface aspects of a single thing in a scene that had to be integrated with normal shots, sometimes awkwardly. And that's when he showed the scene from Anaconda
3.
Dude, you know what? Screw this guy.
But he's right. It was awkward.
No.
The Hoff was in the movie, though. That's not
awkward. That's awkward.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
The other thing, too, that he does not mention is that a lot money dictates everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, I don't know if people may not know this, but it's the same people making Anaconda that are making Transformers. It's the same people. They cycle through. And so it's a community of people, you know, and some people become staff and work on those things and work on the features. But the skill set is fairly transferable between these things. So when you see that 9 times out of 10, you're not seeing the inability of the artist. Sometimes you are. But more often than not, you're seeing the limitations of the entire ecosystem around the artist. You're seeing a lack of money. You're seeing a lack of time. You're seeing too many cooks in the kitchen. No clear vision.
That definitely... That's another podcast, I think.
Ooh,
I
mean, all right.
We've got a lot to say about that.
Yep.
I think.
Yep. Okay.
That's basically you're a baker. You make an amazing cake for $100. Here's $100. Make me your best cake and take all the time you need. Versus here's $5. You've got 5 minutes. Bake a cake.
No, give me a bakery.
give me 3 cakes.
That's right.
For $5.
Deal you sometimes have to take.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So. PJ, you mentioned that we're moving on to the next.
We're going to talk about other pieces of media that we may have caught our attention. More specific, movies, TV. What are you watching? What are you reading? Just really briefly. See if you're a well-rounded person or just a VFX kind of geek.
I got a couple things.
I just started reading Oliver Sacks, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Oh really?
Yeah.
But I haven't. I've never read it.
I only just started. That was on the heels of a book called The Psychopath Inside. Hmm. Which is...
It's about Hollywood?
Yeah, exactly. The Psychopath Inside. It's about a doctor, a scientist, who was studying the brains of psychopaths and learning how to identify patterns in their brain behavior.
Was he on the radio?
Yes.
That was...
He made a lot of noise fantastic. In the last few years because he, part of his study, he eventually did brain scans, blind brain scans on all the members of his family, and one of them showed up as highly psychopathic. All the traits were there, and he's like, oh, shit. So he basically unblinded the results to find out that they were his own brain scans.
Yeah. That was great. That was, and the thing that was, at least the interview that I saw or heard, was he was like, he started asking his friends, people like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You have no empathy. You're kind of shut off in a lot of ways.
In the book, he relates stories. He's like, when I started to look back, I remember all these my friends telling me, like in passing, like, I can't believe you did that. You're such a psychopath. He's like, I thought they were kidding, but these are behavioral scientists and researchers telling me this over and over, and I was just blowing it off.
And of course, the body's in the basement.
And then there's that.
I mean, that was the giveaway.
That's sort of like a monster movie where you're trapped in the house.
Yeah,
it really is. Yeah, and you are you're the house. You don't know it.
Right.
The house and the monster
coming from inside the home.
That's right. Yeah. Ooh, that's good. Don't take it, internet. Don't take it. We're going to do it.
I think it already happened.
Yeah. Oh, okay. John Cusack was in it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a fun movie.
Identity?
Yeah, that was a fun movie. Is that your...
That's all I got.
Okay.
So, I got... are we going to cover Ex Machina at all, or can I, or Machina?
Let's table that for next
week. Yeah, yeah.
I'll see if I can, I'll try and give it a watch before then. I'll have something to add to it, to the conversation.
But I'd say see it. But I've been reading a lot. I'm getting into a reading mode again for the same reasons that this author it says that you should, which is interesting. So the author is James Altucher. He's a guy who has made millions and lost millions several times over. Fully admits he's a little screwy in the head, but he likes to relay his practices, his philosophies, all the while saying, this is not advice, this is what works for me, and then a couple paragraphs later, giving you advice.
So it's like a money-making guide, basically?
It sort of is, but it's more of an attitudinal thing. Mm. And I just... started reading it because I've noticed that I keep myself on track for my own side pursuits, entrepreneurial type ideas, is if I'm also at least relaying it off of another source. So it's, I don't have to copy what they're doing or whatever, but I just want to see that if their mind is working in a similar direction as mine is and whatnot. And one of the things this guy constantly says is that if he doesn't read, he goes off the rails. And I was kind of thinking, that's what I'm trying to do here. Because I've been reading a lot of things about business building and attitudes toward money and whatnot. And when I don't, I sort of stagnate. So now if I have this as sort of a, maybe not a literal guide, but as a, almost like a spiritual guide as to how to keep going, I like it. And it's good to try to keep multiple sources of income going when you're a VFX guy. And so that's kind of what I'm concentrating on. And that's probably another podcast or two or
so
12.
You didn't retire on Anaconda 3?
I mean, the checks are still coming, let me tell you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
because residuals and
looking forward to those every month. Yeah. How about you?
I have three things that I've been looking at, whatever. The one of them is I just went back and started watching Andromeda Strain, the original.
Again. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that there's no way that movie could be made. That movie could be made. They'd do a redo and it'd be an action thing.
But you said the original. Was it remade?
It was as a miniseries, I think, right? With the guy who played Jesus. Is that right?
I believe it was. I don't think it was that many years ago.
Oh, okay.
I think, should be fair. I think I tried watching it. And it didn't catch my attention, I think. But I'll go back and look at it again. But the original is Michael Crichton.
Right.
And Robert Wise movie.
Right.
So, and, you know, it's interesting because a big chunk of that movie is a science procedural,
mm-hmm.
which by today's standards, nobody would watch it. I don't think. But, and it's also, too... you know, the science has come along so far since that. I think the movie's 1971,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're talking to the computer and they're arguing with the computer. And the whole point that the computer would respond to you was that was a science feature. You know, it was like, it's like what old science fiction used to be. It was like, hey, look at this new technology and let's interact with it. And how's it going to affect our lives? And
right.
it's been a lot of fun to watch because it's the stuff is in there is like, they take a good 15 minutes. Like the computer talks to you.
They practically it turn and look at the camera and say, huh?
Right?
At that.
Now, obviously, everybody's phone talks to them. But the thing that I really like, it's also visually interesting, too. Mm. It has a lot of style to it. But one of the things that I do like about that is I like, they try a little too hard, I think, with the characters to have them sort of fight a little bit. You know, everybody's got an attitude for kind of no apparent reason. But I liked the idea that the mystery of the science was enough to make a movie about, you know, and there mm-hmm. were stakes. People were dying of strange, weird things. And so in it, you know, there was like a whole alien aspect to it, not a, you know, ET alien, but like a biological ET alien kind of thing, alien thing. But it made me wonder, like, could you do a science procedural now? You know, have enough drama in there to maintain people's attention and interest and stuff like that. And the stakes are high enough that people care. But, like, would people sit through that? Like, if you go A to B to C, assuming that new interesting things are being revealed, or, and I'm going to make a blanket statement now, too. Are we so anti-intellectual now as a culture that people will be like, I'm not watching that shit, you know, unless there's an explosion, you know? And maybe that's an overgeneralization because I have a feeling like I would watch that movie, and I have a feeling I'm not alone, and I have a feeling too, a big chunk of people like at Comic-Con would see that movie.
But why couldn't you have both? Why
you could, but this movie, specifically this kind of movie, mm-hmm. is it's not both.
Right,
it's really procedural.
I seem to remember because I did watch the film a few years back, and I don't remember much about it except that I found it kind of dull.
Because it's science procedural. Most of it's a science procedural. They, we're looking at the monkey, and then we're going to put so extremes of blah, 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 and then we're going to...
It that was the best part, when they killed the monkey.
Right, right.
It was disturbing because it's all one shot, and you see this monkey, you know...
It's clearly they gassed the monkey or something.
Exposed to this disease, and it looks like the monkey gasps and dies, when in fact... They put him to sleep, but it was disturbing because it's all one shot and
it's real.
Like,
it's
you're like that's a real monkey, and you know he's not happy.
And it was used to great dramatic effect because everybody's got attitude. Everybody's being pulled out of their day to day lives by some heavy handed government entity and stuff, and they're all arguing and bitching and stuff. And then they show the disease, mm-hmm. and then the monkey is real. It's a real monkey, like you've just described. And as soon as that happens, it's all on the monkey, and you see the monkey sort of like freak out and then cripple and then eventually just fall asleep. He's supposed to look like he's dead, but he's obviously asleep. But it's all natural and real. And then as soon as that happens, they cut to the actors and people are like, oh shit. And then now the game is on.
Right.
The game is afoot. You know? And I just, there's something so clean about that, you know, that I was like, and it's so simple. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't have to be a spaceship that blows up, you know, Washington, D.C. I like those movies. Those are fun movies. But sometimes, like, going back to the character reaction, like, you see the thing, and then you see the character reaction, and you're like, that's not good.
Well, what about Contagion? Boom. Did you see Contagion?
I did. I don't recall much of Contagion.
It's
Soderbergh,
it wasn't,
right?
It wasn't strictly a procedural, but it had a very sort of dry sensibility.
There was a lot of science in it.
There was a lot of science, and there was a lot of sort of like, and then this happens, and then over here this happens. And it's just sort of like felt like it was very... almost objective in its view of all the different things that happen.
It was a vignette kind of thing.
Yeah, and even though it was affecting the whole world, it tried to take these specific people and just follow them. And there was a moment where what's the gal, the actress who
Gwyneth Paltrow?
Gwyneth Paltrow, thank you. She was the one who contracted it first, and she was in the hospital. She had some sort of really bad looking seizure.
Right.
It looked painful.
Right.
And then when the doctors were doing the postmortem and they opened up her skull and looked at her brain, you didn't see anything. They didn't show you anything, but right. just the reaction.
Oh,
as
right.
As soon as they opened up that Pandora's box, they were just like, oh, dear God. And you're just like, I don't know what they just saw.
But it's not good.
It can't be good.
But, okay, so for me, like, that's worth 10 robots. You know what I mean? Because, sure. And maybe this is an age thing, too, which I'm totally willing to chalk it up as an age thing. But like, those are stakes. I have no idea what a 900-foot robot looks like going down the street. I don't have any real life. You know,
well, and like, you gotta watch Gwyneth Paltrow in Sky Captain if you want to know what a giant, because she was being chased by giant robots.
It all comes together in that movie.
Does.
You know, I had something else I was gonna say about that, but I can't remember because too many robots. I'll jump to the two other things. Mm. So the other one is a book. I think I might have sent you guys the title of the book. It's called Made to Stick, and I can't remember the author's name. I'll dig it up.
It didn't stick.
Yeah. It's two brothers that wrote the book. But the premise of the book, I think, is very timely if you make content, any kind of content, or actually if you're just trying to get anybody's attention for any purpose or reason right now. It is the most clear-minded, concise, smart collection of, I don't know if you call them tips, but it's almost like psychologically how these things work. But the whole premise is, how do you introduce an idea to somebody and have them and maintain their attention.
Mm.
Maintain their attention to the point of actually them becoming proactive on it.
Yeah.
So they give several fantastic examples, but one that really stuck with me is, you know, when the big thing is, you know, when if you're creating a new business, the whole thing is do a market research study. You know, who else is doing this? How big is your audience? Is there enough customers to make this a viable business? That's what's called a gap. There's a gap between a need and somebody offering the solution to that need. Okay, so like if there's not enough green tennis shoes out there, somebody is going to get in the green tennis shoe business and fill that gap.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's cool about entertainment is it's our job to create the gap. So there. People, when they go into the movie theaters, don't have a gap. They don't know the story. There's no gap created. So the first act is about creating a gap. Mm. It's creating a problem that then the audience needs filled. And the thing that was so cool about this book is like that impulse is so powerful that you will sit through a crappy movie to see how it turns out.
Right.
And I was like, that is absolutely true. Like if it's compelling at all, you know, or even just annoying, like, you know, the butler did it. But you're like, did the butler do it? And then you just watch the whole movie, you know?
Well, I want to see how they find out that the butler did it.
But that's how compelling and strong that impulse to fill that gap is. And I thought that is such a cool, interesting insight into our brains that we need mysteries solved.
Hmm.
And I also thought it was interesting, too, that the whole idea of you have to create a problem, you know, and that's what anybody who tells stories do. We make a problem for the person. And the thing that's even more ironic is, as if we don't have enough problems in our life already, we go look for that. You know, we're like, well, I don't have enough problems. Where's another one?
Well, that's advertising. If you watch, you know, most commercials, they start with your problem. Do you not have shiny enough skin?
Right.
People have shiny skin? You know, it's right. Like, well, should my skin be shiny? I didn't realize.
That's right. They created a problem you didn't know you had. Like,
well, wrong, stupid. It's too shiny. You want to have matte skin like these fine people.
Matte skin. And then so I highly recommend that book, and I don't know the people, good luck to them, they made a good book, they deserve to
made to stick.
And it's been out a while. I think it came out in 2007, so it's not a new book, but
okay.
And then the third thing was something that I've been fighting with a little bit too. This could be 12 podcasts.
Mm.
But I've been trying to develop a little show that talks about secrets of storytelling.
Mm.
And I'm thinking I might want to do it as a YouTube series, a little YouTube series. And I've been wrestling with it because it goes back to the made to stick thing. One of the things that I'm running into is there's an inherent complexity in what I'm trying to convey.
Mm.
And I know that YouTube is a box full of chewing gum. You know I don't have anybody's attention for 20 minutes, nor do I think I want to commit regularly to a 20-minute show, you know? And so I have been struggling with how can you convey complex information in an interesting, fun way that people will remember, and you're out of there in 7 minutes max, 5-3 preferable, the length of a song. And it's been beating me up because I've tried everything. And then one of the other things too is I thought, well, I can write concisely, so I can't off the cuff do this, you know, but if I like laser beamed it, then I'd write up. So then I went and, you know, we really are gonna have to start our show notes because all the gadgets and stuff we like and books and stuff. Yep. But I bought this little thing for a camera. It's it was like $167, I think. It's a little teleprompter. Mm. I don't know if you see this thing over here.
Oh, cool.
But it works. You use your iPad and you put your iPad in there, and there's this software that is a teleprompter, and it's listening, and you basically talk out loud, and it scrolls as you talk. It knows where you are in the script. Cool. So I was thinking, so I'll do that. But last night I finally had I haven't quite had my come to Jesus on this yet, but I don't know that I can solve this problem, and it's irritating me. So anyway, that's the third thing.
Well,
so.
If I can give you a tip on that.
Yeah. Tell me how you know me that I don't know.
It's the one on the left. exactly. Now, just judging by this Weta effect video, mm-hmm. which is, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, really poorly written. And it was, I believe, written because it sounds like the guy.
It is. He's reciting something.
He's reciting it. It's poorly written. The points aren't really made in any substantive way.
And here we are talking about it.
But we're talking about it, and it made a lot. It's made the rounds online. And I think part of it is that you are distracted from what he's saying and the bad story he's telling, because he is using all the spectacle that he is bemoaning in the video itself.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's this constant montage of spectacle to describe why spectacle is bad. So I think the lesson to be learned there is if you can use a bunch of CGI spectacle,
which I can,
no matter what you say, people will get behind it.
Here's the other thing too, is he's already fanning flames of something that's already out there, of like CG's making everything shit. I mean, stupid. He's not the first guy that's come out with that. So he already had, the gap already existed use a made to stick thing.
Those space monsters look totally fake.
Right. And that's the thing that's ruining the movie. Never mind the fact that you can't follow the story, or it's so dumb it's not worth following, you know, or so poorly written. You're like, I don't know. And this is a throwaway too, to talk about Transformers. This to me, like, I think it was the second Transformers, but one of them, there is literally gigantic robots talking to each other for a long time because it's all exposition. I'm like, am I really watching $200 million of robots telling me the story? Like, just give me the script. I mean, like, this, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
How are we doing on time?
We should be wrapping up. Should we wrap up?
Let's wrap this thing up.
Sounds good.
You have now wasted another perfectly good hour of your life.
Keep clicking those keyframes.
Yep. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
10 Giant Robots is created and distributed by the 10 Giant Robots Radio Network in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. Our theme music was created by the incredibly talented Shane Knight. Follow us on Twitter @10GiantRobots or @10GiantRobots.com.